From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Laura Meckler, staff writer for the Wall Street Journal. Our moderator is contributing editor to the National Journal, Tom DeFrank.
Good day, everyone from Washington. Here are the issues. President Trump has returned home from a 12-day trip through Asia, touting what he called historic achievements without offering much detail. After nearly four decades, Robert Mugabe has been deposed as Zimbabwe's strongman, or maybe not. In Washington, Republicans pressed ahead on a tax bill that would eliminate many loopholes from the tax code while creating billions in tax savings. Critics charge most of those tax savings are mostly earmarked for the rich. And Republicans furiously maneuvered to remove its candidate for a United States Senate seat from Alabama after he was accused of sexual improprieties with several young women decades ago. One of the accusers was 14 years old at the time. So let's start on a more of an upbeat note with President Trump's trip to Asia. Linda, the president had a major announcement after he returned, but the major announcement was basically a recap of the trip in which he said great things were done, historic things were done. And he also said, quote, America's standing in the world has never been stronger. How do you rate his trip in terms of real accomplishments?
Let's see. I would say there weren't a lot of major accomplishments. I would say the trip presented the contradictions of Donald Trump. On the one hand, he's trying to get the world to rally behind him to confront North Korea with its nuclear threat. And at the same time, he's made it clear that America wants to go its own way on trade.
That's for sure. That was one of the themes of his campaign. And it appears that he talked a lot about cutting a new deal with the Chinese on trade, but there's no real evidence that happened, at least so far. Laura, how would you rate his trip?
Well, I agree with Linda. I mean, I don't think there was, at the end of the day, much to show for it. The question's going to come, we'll see the effects of this trip in the months and years really to come. On one hand, he set out a strong message to North Korea and worked to try to rally the region behind the U.S. effort to try to rein in North Korea and its, you know, very unsettling nuclear ambitions. On the other hand, though, on trade, you know, he sort of had this America first, go it alone attitude. And meanwhile, all the other countries that had been part of the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, of course, was a signature agreement for the Obama administration and that Trump has pulled us out of it, they basically began work on their own for their own free trade deal. So it was clear that the countries in the region are sort of moving forward without us. And, you know, one of the fears has long been that China would be the dominant player in that region and the U.S. would not have as much influence when it needs it. And this is sort of an evidence that that's on its way when the region essentially going ahead on this important trade deal without the U.S. So there are consequences to these decisions.
That dynamic seems to me, Linda, to be somewhat similar to the climate change agreement where the rest of the world is basically moving ahead. One of the things that the president talked about a lot is something Laura just mentioned, which is pressing the Chinese to get tougher with North Korea. Linda, do you have any sense that the president had any kind of a breakthrough on North Korea with President Xi?
I don't think so. And I think that Donald Trump perhaps overestimates the ability of President Xi to really rein in North Korea or China's willingness. China is very concerned about security on its border. They don't want a wave of, they don't want to necessarily overthrow the North Korean regime. They don't want that a wave of North Koreans rushing into China. And so we seem to be at a stalemate, although there's this tendency, I think, to look at North Korea as a zero-sum game. Either we go to war with them or we allow them to have nuclear weapons. And we saw other government officials this week talking about the diplomatic option, maybe a third way, actually talking to the North Koreans. Donald Trump himself has talked about a willingness to speak to the North Koreans, even as he tweets out an insult toward Kim Jong-un, calling him short and fat.
Yeah, the Twitter traffic keeps continuing, escalating insults between between both leaders. Laura, what is your sense of how well President Xi and President Trump got along? To listen to the president, president feels like they have a fabulous relationship now that the personal diplomacy that is important to President Trump is taking hold, according to the president. My basic take on presidents when they're abroad is that most countries, while it's valuable and useful to have a personal relationship with another head of state or head of government, basically most countries react and make their policy decisions based on self-interest.
Well, right. That's exactly right. So for President Trump, so much of it is personal. It's like what really matters is whether they like him. And that's going to determine whether we get our way. And maybe that's worked for him in the past, but I don't know that it necessarily works on the world stage. He was just sort of, so excited and so happy about literally the red carpet being rolled out for him. I think foreign leaders kind of have his number. They've figured out that the way to, have him on your good side is to just, be incredibly complimentary, of him. And I think he referred to the visit in China as a state plus plus visit. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this is bigger and better than anybody's ever had. And that's because I'm the best president that's ever been. That seems to be sort of the subtext. Mm-hmm. But where does that translate? Exactly as you said, how does that translate into the U.S. actually getting what it wants? I don't think we know yet. And in fairness, even if had done everything perfectly, I don't know that we would know yet either. So I think these trips, I've found it takes a while sometimes to know whether they've actually produced anything. But I do think that he's very into those personal relationships. And I don't know that in and of itself does a whole lot. I mean, look at Putin. I mean, he has talked about in laudatory terms about Putin and about how they get along. Does that change anything in terms of Russian posture towards the U.S.? I don't think so.
Definitely remains to be seen. Something else that remains to be seen is what's going on or not going on in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe, the 93-year-old leader of what used to be called Rhodesia when it was a British colony 30 years ago, and his wife Grace are supposedly under house arrest, and the military has essentially taken control of the government and the country. It's not clear whether this is a coup, although it has all the earmarks of a coup. At least at the moment, it's a bloodless coup, if that's what it is. Linda, why has the military taken on Mugabe and threatening his hold on power?
Robert Mugabe is 93 years old. A lot of people have been waiting many years for Robert Mugabe to depart the scene. Robert Mugabe is also preparing for his final departure and has placed his family in effectively in the line of succession, principally his wife, who's in her early 50s. This, I think, has not gone well with the people who surround Mugabe. They don't like the idea of a family succession and have, it would appear to be maybe a soft coup. Robert Mugabe has turned up in public since he was placed under house arrest at a university graduation and at another event with some other African leaders. So it appears they're trying to kind of ease him out gently and not create potential for violence or other unrest. Zimbabwe has a terrible history under Mugabe of human rights abuses, violence, economic disaster. Zimbabwe used to be one of the economic gems of Africa, and that vision ended a long time ago. And I think what people are looking for is sort of a soft landing of a tough situation.
Right. And you get the feeling, Laura, that part of this is motivated by classic political infighting. I believe there's a faction of the ruling class in Zimbabwe that did not like the fact that about a week or 2 weeks or so ago, Mugabe fired his vice president. Mm-hmm. And that was a view widely seen as an effort to clear the way for Mugabe's 50-something wife, Grace, to succeed him. And I think that did not go over well with the army. And so we will have to see. You mentioned, Linda, the hyperinflation in Zimbabwe. It used to be called the breadbasket of Africa. It was had such a strong economy and an agricultural economy, and that's not the case anymore. Mugabe confiscated many of the farms in the country and turned them over to cronies or others. Laura, what do you think is happening, and where is this going to go? You get the feeling that Mugabe is not going to end up in a morgue anywhere, but it sounds like that the days of his total power seem to be going south.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, he is, 93 years old. So, I mean, obviously we're coming to an end of this regime one way or another. And I guess the military is making sure it would be the other. Let's keep in mind, it's not like this was some, you know, democratically elected government that, you know, was, you know, the people were so enamored with, and, you know, that the military has, you know, subverted the will of the people to oust him. I mean, this is a repressive regime, you know, from the get-go. So this is not exactly, it's a complicated situation, I think, politically. You know, where it goes now, you know, as South Africa is playing a big role in trying to negotiate this, it looks like they're all kind of at the table, quite literally. There were pictures released of Mugabe sitting at the table talking to them. That sort of fueled speculation that we might be near resolution. It doesn't seem that was the case. Mm-hmm. But it looks like maybe they'll be able to, you know, work it out, shall we say, under pressure.
We'll know a lot more about this and how it works out when we're back at these microphones a week from now. But for the moment, we're going to change to other topics when we come back from a short break.
More of Issues in the News in just a moment. This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. And a reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Laura Meckler, Staff Writer for the Wall Street Journal. Our moderator is Tom DeFrank, contributing editor for the National Journal.
So right before the break, we were talking about global politics. Now we're going to switch to domestic American politics. At the top of the legislative agenda is a furious push by the Republicans to get a tax bill to President Trump's desk by the end of the year, or as he says, a Christmas present for the American people. The Republicans in the House of Representatives passed their version of a tax cut. And they continue to say that almost everybody will get a tax break. But it's clear that most middle-class citizens will get a tax break, but it'll be far more modest than wealthy Americans, and a lot smaller than businesses. Linda, what is your guess about the prospects of this bill becoming law? It now goes to the Senate, mm-hmm. and there are many differences between the House version and the Senate version, which has not been passed. What do you think are the prospects?
I think they're pretty slim. I'm having a bit of a sense of deja vu from the effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, did not happen. The House bill seemed to pass relatively easily, though I don't think the president will have a big ceremony on the White House on the South in the Rose Garden to celebrate that as he did with Obamacare repeal. This, as you said, Tom, the Senate version of the legislation is very different, and the optics are already pretty bad. The Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a nonpartisan committee on Capitol Hill of economists and accountants, which helps write legislation, they've now estimated that the Senate bill in the next decade for Americans earning $75,000 or less per year would likely pay more in taxes and not less. And you can bet the Democrats are going to blast that assessment sky high to everybody who will listen, and make it very difficult for the Republicans in the Senate. Bear in mind also that the Republicans only have a very slim majority. You've already had some members expressing skepticism about that bill, and I think it's I would say almost impossible for them to get it through.
Laura, let me ask you the same question. It's pretty clear from public opinion polling. Several different polls have said by a large margin the American people believe that this tax bill, which is endorsed by President Trump, is not good for the middle class, and that these polls say show rather convincingly that this bill conceived to give better tax breaks and far bigger tax breaks to the wealthiest of Americans, the 1%. So the question is, why, if that is the case, why are the Republicans pressing so hard for this bill?
Well, I think that you focused on the negative parts of the bill, but there also are some things that they very much want with this bill. For starters, a very big decrease in the corporate tax rate, which they believe will spur investment and help juice the economy. So that, you know, we have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world, and this would change that from, I believe, 35% down to 20%. So that's one thing that it does. There are a variety of somewhat of tax simplifications in the tax code. Most people do get a tax code, at least initially. A lot of those tax cuts expire. But there is an effort to give everyday people tax cuts as well. So there are, you know, people, we all will be collectively as a country paying less in taxes. It's, in fact, to the tune of $1.5 trillion over 10 years, which is how much this bill would add to the deficit. So we are actually going to be paying less money. And if you're a Republican, that's pretty much why you came to Washington, is to lower taxes.
Right.
The problem for some Republicans is that in order to do that, there are so many things that they're having, other taxes that they're having to raise. They're having to close so many different types of loopholes, not loopholes, deductions, I should say, in some cases, loopholes that are favored by people. They're having to, in the case of the Senate bill, most dramatically, they're ending the requirement that all Americans have insurance. Now, that saves money. Why does that save money? Well, because fewer people will buy it, and fewer people will get subsidies to buy it. 13 million fewer people will have health insurance. So there are consequences to cutting all of these taxes. You have to at least pay for some of them. So That's the problem they have. I am not quite as pessimistic as Linda is about the prospects of this passing. The Republican Party wants this very, very badly. And for the most part, this is something that unites Republicans, the desire to cut taxes. So if there is a way to get this done, I think that they will get it done. Now, I don't know whether there is a way or not. There is a lot of differences between the House and the Senate bill. But keep in mind, the House bill, lots of controversy in there. It passed by a somewhat comfortable margin. The Senate bill just passed a Senate committee on a party line vote. So this is not dead by any means.
Well, I agree that it's not dead, but it's still got a ways to go. And there's another dynamic driving this Republican bill, and that is you touched on it briefly, Laura. The Republicans need a win. They need something to be able to go back to their constituencies in the November 2018 election and say, look what we did. Look what we did for you. The president does not have a real win legislatively this year. I mean, he's doing well from a Republican standpoint and placing very conservative lawyers and judges on appellate courts. And those are lifetime appointments, and so that's going to be one of the significant achievements of this presidency. But he doesn't have a legislative victory that amounts to anything. And this would be a huge talking point for Republicans who are fearing the worst in 2018 in the off-year elections to have a very strong comeback. So we will see. There's also some pressure from donors, Republican donors, who say, we need this, we want this, and if we don't get it, we're not going to open our checkbooks as readily as we usually do. And so that's an element of this. Now let's go from the political to the tawdry, and also political, I guess I should say. The Senate, the Republican candidate for the Senate from Alabama, in an election that to fill the seat vacated by Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, who is now the United States Attorney General. The Republican candidate to succeed him is named Roy Moore, a controversial judge, who has been thrown off, who has been expelled from two judgeships in his career already. But he is the Republican nominee for this fill this vacancy in a December 12th election. In the last 2 weeks, half a dozen to 9 or 10 women have come forward saying, he groped me, he assaulted me. One of the alleged victims was 14 years old, which, if that's true, would have been a felony at the time. There's been a whole lot of reporting that says that Roy Moore, Judge Moore, had a reputation for dating much younger women. The Senate Majority Leader in Washington, Senator Mitch McConnell, has said he should withdraw. The Alabama Republican Party has dug in its heels, and they're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the dynamics here don't look very good for the Republicans. It seems like there's a good chance that a Democrat, believe it or not, might have a real shot at taking that seat, further complicating President Trump's very narrow majority in the U.S. Senate. How do you think this is going to play out?
I think no matter what happens on December 12th, it's bad news for the Republicans. Either the Democrat wins, which, as you say, lowers the majority even further to 51-49, but if Roy Moore wins, you've got an uncontrollable, disgraced senator sitting in the Senate at a time when sexual harassment of women is in the news, and some men in the case of Kevin Spacey. But this has become a snowball situation of sexual misdeeds coming to light. Most recently, Al Franken, a Democratic senator from Minnesota. So this is a bipartisan or a nonpartisan problem. But in terms of actual electoral impact, Alabama is center stage right now.
Now, Laura, some Republican members of the U.S. Senate are saying if Roy Moore is elected, they will move to expel him from the Senate. Is that possible? I mean, can the Senate expel a duly elected member?
Yeah. The Senate can expel him if they want to. They can try to do that. They can have an investigation. They can expel him. You know, that said, there are political consequences to that, because Roy Moore does have the support of a large slice of the Republican base. Now, that may not be a majority of the country or even a majority of the Republican Party, but it will really inflame this intra-Republican war that's going on. A lot of people will be super annoyed that this guy, if he gets elected with all of this public, the idea that, oh, you're going to just substitute your Washington judgment for the judgment of the voters of Alabama, I think in certain circles will not go over well. That said, him remaining will be a huge problem for Republicans as well, because he'll be just there constantly causing them problems, constantly requiring other Republicans to respond to the things that he's done and the things that he's said. So frankly, I actually think it's probably better for Mitch McConnell if Doug Jones, the Democrat, wins. Granted, it lowers his majority by one, but he still has a majority. He will presumably only serve in that seat for 2 years, because then there'll be another election, and it's doubtful that the Republicans will nominate such a flawed candidate again. You know, we'll see.
Sometimes politicians talk about a win-win solution. I think this is a lose-lose situation for everybody, but especially the Republicans. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Laura Meckler, staff writer for The Wall Street Journal, and Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites, and I'm Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Thanks for listening.